$1,000 and find one lonely sock weeping because its mate ran off. Well, you see, there is a verse with that. If they leave, let them leave. If they wish to stay, let them stay. They are not under obligation should the sock depart. Something like that. And you see, once you've put the imprint, once you've ruined that, the only thing it's good for is the garbage. Now, the human soul is not as critical. And the reason for that is because the human soul was imparted by God, and God knows how to repair it. The thing is, of course, that it takes God to do the repairing. And those of you that have injured souls, well, apparently you don't want your souls repaired. You're happy the way you are, fragmented, instead of operating under the full blessing that God has available for you regardless of your past circumstances. And if you get nothing out of this part or this segment of our study, at least get that, that if I do not enjoy what God has for me totally in marriage and operate under 100% blessing available, it's no one's fault but my own. Because I am still alive, I am still doing that phenomena called breathing, and therefore God left me here for a purpose, and apparently, since I've rejected it, the purpose will be to show other people what they shouldn't be as a loser in the Christian life. See, the beauty of soul repair is that regardless of what you've done to your soul in the past, God is able to repair it. There are a lot of foolish things we do to our souls, one of which, of course, is devastating, and that is premarital sexual relationship. That's where the soul is fragmented. And it does not have the ability to properly read or to retain information that's placed upon it, the same as an injured floppy or an injured hard drive. And there's nothing more devastating, by the way, when you try to repair a hard drive that's bad, and the more you try to repair it, the worse off it becomes. Again, the only solution to that is throw it away. Point 18. Premarital sexual activity often hinders interpersonal marital relationship. Postmarital sexual activity is a learning process, and therefore nothing that you picked up from the gutter is going to help you in that learning process. As a matter of fact, generally it is a hindrance. You need know nothing about sex when you get married. Nothing. Probably the less you know, the greater you'll appreciate it. I remember once I was talking to a couple, and I made an awful assumption. The awful assumption was that I was talking to two virgins who had never experienced orgasm. And so I said something about orgasm, and I said, and it's very difficult for me to even go into the subject because, number one, I'm self-conscious of the fact that I'm talking about something as intimate as that. And then, two, that it's very difficult to explain when you've never experienced it. And the woman just squared off and said to me, "Oh, I've had many." And I, so, of course, I had to drop the subject because that was even more embarrassing. I wish she'd have kept her mouth shut and played, you know, virgin possum instead of telling me she'd had many orgasms. Now, the point of the matter is very simple, that what you bring into your marriage greatly affects it, sometimes beneficially, and then other times in areas of destruction. The things you learned in the gutter regarding sex, disregard. Even if they might be closely true, disregard them. Try to blank them out of your mind before marriage. Now, for those of you that are married, why, again, you may need some soul repair. This is where doctrine comes in. The learning process is hindered by preconceived ideas in any area of life. You see, the easiest person to teach doctrine to is the person who has had no doctrine. The easiest person to teach any principle of doctrine to is the person who is newly saved, who have no preconceived theological dispositions. But the hardest people to talk to are those who have preconceived doctrinal positions. They come to Bible class and they sit there and they weigh everything on the basis of their preconceived notions. And if I tend to agree with them, they go along with it. For instance, a non-dispensationalist will sit with absolute horror when he hears that I'm a dispensationalist. A person who comes to this local assembly who has spoken in tongues. See, speaking in tongues is paralleled and, in fact, almost identical to premarital sex, because the relationship of the growth of the believer who has spoken tongues and the relationship of appreciation of sexual responses postmarital are almost identical. So you see, when I say that we're studying marriage, we're dealing with more than just marriage. We're dealing with life, of which marriage is a part, an integral part. But people pick up things from the gutter of theology. And they come to class and they have this preconceived idea. I think personally that we recently lost a couple because they had preconceived theological positions that vastly differed from what I teach. They could never grasp the idea of grace and the freedom in grace. You see, legalism is that awful fragmenting effect on the soul that minimizes the ability of a person to ever learn true doctrinal concepts. So when you get a person that is newly saved, they've had no religious, quote-unquote, experiences whatever, they are virgin in the area of their spiritual life, boy, they are teachable, as some of you are. We have people here at Westside that were never involved in any other church but Westside Bible Church. And you see, it's right man, right woman. This is your first marriage, and hopefully your only marriage. But there are some that have gone whoring around, excuse the expression. Some of them are still whoring around. Now, two ways you can take the word whoring, by the way. One is the English word, which means illicit sexual relationship, or the Hebrew and or Greek word use, meaning they just dance around from one church to the other. Whichever pleases you, use it applicably, if you would. If the one insults you, say, well, I danced around instead of screwing around. Can we get that off the tape, you think? I don't know. That's one of those words that pop out every so often. Now, you see, had that couple been here and I said that, I'd have heard stained glass shattering from now until Tuesday. Some of you just sat there and you said, what did he say? What was wrong with that? Because you're relaxed. You see, you have no problem with it. Some people are so in tune with their own tune. And if you don't sing their tune, you're off key. And their tune may not be correct. You say, well, isn't really that a form of arrogance? No, it's not a form of arrogance. It's arrogance. Not the form thereof. It's probably the quintessence of arrogance. I can't think of anything more arrogant than legalism in the Christian life, in that particular sphere. 1 Corinthians 6:18, point 19, says that fornication is sin against your own body. We took this up on Tuesday night. And again, if you were not here, please get the tape, because I took the entire lesson in giving 1 Corinthians 6:18 its proper application with regard to our current subject. Then the next night, you remember, on Wednesday, or even possibly last night, I corrected one portion, or not really corrected, but added to it, the concept of the resurrection and why it's mentioned within that context. Interestingly enough, I was reading today ahead in 1 Corinthians, assuming that I was going to be teaching it, which I'm not, but nevertheless, just seeing the context, and what Paul does is a typical both Hebraic and Greek style of writing. You see, a Hebraic style of writing, and this is the way the Revelation is set up, is where you give the outline first. And so you go point one, and then you have an outline. Let's call this A. And then over here, his second point is B. His third point is C, and subsequent. Now, he may cover this and say chapter 1. Then in chapter 2, he covers A, B, and C all together in a verse. And it sounds like they're disassociated. But then in chapter 3, he picks up A and then gives you two chapters on A. And then the next two chapters are on B, and the next two chapters are on C. And if you don't understand that, it sounds like it's just a muddled bit of information. I heard a man recently say that he was a professor at, you probably heard him too, if you were here while he was here. He was a professor at Oral Roberts University. And he said, and I quote, I never did get involved in exegeting 1 Corinthians 12 or 14, because obviously they would have fired me on the spot. And so I responded by saying, you missed it, buddy. It's not just 1 Corinthians 12 and 14, but rather 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14. Because if you understand the Pauline concept of teaching, he introduced the error of tongues long before that in the opening chapters of 1 Corinthians. Now he goes into detail, beginning at chapter 12, continuing in chapter 13, and developing further in chapter 14. It's an error to see the 13th chapter as the love chapter, and that makes it isolated. So you see, this is what I did today, and as I was reading along, just anticipating, I saw that Paul picked up the idea of premarital sex in chapter 7, but if you continue, he keeps going on with it in the latter part of that chapter. Then he also talked about, and we discussed it briefly when we were covering this, you remember the King James, meats for the belly, or food for the stomach, and then he just says a little bit about it in chapter 7. Go to chapter 8. Now he says, now the things whereof you wrote concerning meats offered to idols. He goes into great detail in chapter 8 and 9 with regard to eating meats that's been offered to an idol or that will cause a brother to stumble. And then finally, he goes from there into the gift factor and then on through. When you understand Paul, you understand me, quite frankly, because I do that often. So you'll say, well, what relationship did that statement have with what he's going to be teaching us? Sit back. It may not be tonight. See, the problem I have, I can't give you 15 chapters in one night. I wish I could. What has always intrigued me is that the Corinthians read that letter and probably at one sitting, which most of us never do when we're reading the Scriptures. I mean, it was a letter intended to be read in one sitting. What do? We have our devotions, we read chapter 1. That's like getting a letter from your loved one, and you say, boy, I've been waiting for this letter, I don't know how long I've been waiting, and then you say, now I'll read just the first paragraph. And then I'll set it aside, and tomorrow I'll read the second paragraph. No, you go over that, and over that, and over that, until you digest every word. And then you say, I wonder what he or she meant in this part. Well, I'll have to write back and find out. But when it comes to the Scriptures, we didify it. We get involved in the ditty aspect. We just hit a little ditty here, a little ditty there, and that suffices. I'm trying to challenge you, when you sit to read the Scripture, it'll take on a whole new flavor if you read the entire book. Say, but some of them are so long. Start with small books. Simple enough, till you develop your reading habits in that area. Start with 3 John. Shouldn't take you too long. Then back up to 2 John, then 1 John. I mean, you're now up to 5 chapters. See, and then go to 1 Thessalonians. Not too bad. You're still keeping in the 5 chapter range. Go to Titus. You're backing up a little bit. Okay? And you can go to 1 and 2 Timothy. You don't have to sit down and read 1 Corinthians or 1 and 2 Corinthians or Romans in one sitting. I mean, 16 chapters, especially the last chapter of Romans. Greet so-and-so and greet so-and-so. By the time you're finished greeting, you're asleep. I've also found, by the way, if you have insomnia, best cure for the insomniac is just start reading your Bible. Boy, you'll fall asleep fast. I can appreciate why some people have problems sleeping. They do it during Bible class. All right, point 19. It breaks the continuity, you see. The one flesh is biological rapport as well as mental, soulish, and spiritual rapport. We took up this subject with detail last evening. Point 20. Premarital sexual experience establishes the attitude a person will have toward sex for the rest of his life. Again, you see, we're simply discussing it without doctrinal variance, without any doctrinal intrusion. What this is simply saying, and I agree with the point, you establish certain sexual habits before marriage. Now, again, look at the sphere as the sphere of marriage. If there is zero sex out here, and that includes sex with self, and you all understand what that is. Zero sex out here. You enter the marriage relationship based on zero sex, perfectly prepared to learn. But if you come in here with 100 principles of sex, regardless of what they are, you have found you've developed a pattern. You've developed a technique, okay, regardless of what that technique happens to be, which in many cases have no application whatever. Let me give you an illustration. This is kind of rough for me, so relax. Let's say this person has had 100 experiences with sex with self. Now, they have to have sex with somebody else. I mean, after all, that's an intrusion. See, they've been so used to holding their own, they can't get used to somebody else. Play on words. Play on sex, too, by the way. Don't you see? you establish a pattern. And once you get in here, that pattern governs. Hey, we're creatures of habit. Now again, I'm suggesting that this is based on minus doctrinal intrusion. And I say intrusion because it's a good intrusion. I've had intrusions that are great. You know, if somebody called me up in the middle of the night and said, I just won a sweepstakes, I would enjoy that intrusion. But somebody called me the other night at 10 minutes after 12 and asked for John. And I said, whoa! Now, first of all, they were fortunate that I was awake. But it didn't make any difference. I said, do you realize what time it is? The person said, oh, I'm sorry. I doubt if they'll ever call me again at that time. Some of you have made the mistake of calling our house between 2 and 4. You say, what does that mean? That is our nap time. And we've gotten smart now over the years. We just shut our phones off. But occasionally, I leave mine on like a fool. And it's ironic that some of the people that do it are members of my own family. My own daughters call me, and they know how I used to get at that time. And they expect me to be hospitable. What? Dad, did I wake you? No! Or were you awake? Well, I wasn't until now. Oh, I am a beast at that time. Don't ever do that. You see, you establish a habit. I've been doing that for 35 years. No, actually more than that. I started napping when I was about 14. And I enjoy it. I'll tell you, I look forward to that. The only problem with that is when we're driving cross country. And, man, 2 o'clock comes, and look out. I'm looking for a place to sack for a while. And generally, it's ironic, but I do. I'm driving. But I'm not as sharp as I normally would be. Then around 4 o'clock, I say, how far have we gone, hon? You know, she'll tell me, great, we covered a lot of distance in that period of time while I napped. Oh, my eyes are open and I can see what's going on, but not so sharp. You say, well, why don't you let somebody else drive and you nap? Can't do that. No. Again, develop too many bad habits. Can't have anybody else. I'll go down the road this way with somebody else driving. Man, my eyes get twice the size. If I lose my arms, then somebody else can drive. In the meantime, if I ever drive with you, by the way, count it a privilege, because I hate it. You say, why? I don't trust you. You establish. Now, and by the way, let's be realistic in some cases. Well, depending upon how long this person was single. It's absurd, but it happens. I mean, after a while, it only takes one. And you don't end with one. Now, I got to go back to that. That was all right. And now they're saying, oh, it's healthy to do that. No, it isn't. It isn't either. You say, well, the person has to have that release, that sexual release. God has even provided that as well. It's called dreams, for the male especially. Now, if you don't dream, you have no imagination. I would suggest you may have the gift of celibacy. You may not even know it. Now, let's assume that has happened. Here's what's happened. There's the barrier again. And unfortunately, you bring in only... See, who were you attracted to here? Come on, self. Now, is it difficult for this type of person to ever have a meaningful relationship with somebody else who's intruded in their self-joy? Difficult. Now, the wife says, hey, I want you to spend some time with me. And I've done some studies on this as well. See, when I went to college, I took a lot of psychology, and a lot of it was abnormal, taught by abnormal people. And one of them had to do with abnormal sexual activity. And I'm glad I studied it. A lot of the stuff, by the way, that I'm giving you is right out of the textbook, whether you realize it or not. And many men that were interviewed who had had multiple experiences in masturbation admitted that it wasn't as good with a woman. They got more sexual satisfaction out of self. But you see, if there's zero here, you take nothing in and you're pure. Your soul is pure. So I don't care what the world says about it being healthy. I'm telling you, it's soul destructive. Point 20 then, premarital sexual experiences establishes the attitude a person will have towards sex for the rest of his life. And because premarital sex is sinful, it implies the orgastic quality will be less than under the optimum circumstances of marriage. You see, God designed sex and marriage as a reinforcement of a relationship between two people. And what you have done is you have violated that invention of God. You have decided that you can have a relationship with self. I know some people, for example, they would get very upset at homosexuality or lesbianism, but they would think nothing about self-orgastic experience. What's the difference? In all three cases, it's the wrong person. A man with a man, it's the wrong person. A woman with a woman, wrong person. A man with himself, wrong person. A woman with herself, wrong person. God never designed for you to respond to self sexually. He designed you to respond to an opposite number sexually. I know this may be rough stuff for some, but it's got to be taught if we're going to be consistent with the policy of this local assembly. You're going to hear it all, whether you like it or not. Now, I'm not going to pull any punches, by the way, because if I do, then I can't live with me. Then I have to say I'm not doing my job. I know there's probably at least one of you that has said already, well, you know, he could cover this very quickly, and besides, I don't know why he's really making a big issue out of that. I don't even think that belongs in the pulpit. Well, go somewhere else and be stupid the rest of your life. So who are you fighting with? I don't know. I decided somebody didn't like it, and so I'm going to tear into him. What's the difference? That's my prerogative. You imaginary person, get out of here. They probably have already left. Go have a good time in the other church. All right. And you can hear cute little platitudes by platypuses quacking around with their webbed feet. Duck brains. And they're not even from Australia. Say, what is that man saying? I'm talking about a duck billed platypus. It's a duck-like creature that lays eggs. It's a mammal. It's just very confusing. But you see, Australia is loaded with confusing animals. I think one of the most exciting words is a word to describe kangaroos and the type. You know what it is? Marsupials. I think that has a ring to it. Marsupial. It's a marsupial. I says, what are you talking about? It's got a pouch. It carries its young in a pouch. Say, I do that. You're a marsupial. No, you're not. Can we get back to this, please? Leave me alone. You say, you got yourself into that. Right. Look, the orgastic quality in marriage should be 100%. But if you brought in 50% slop, don't you see what it does to that 100% potential? It's already cut it down to 50%. You say, what's the slop? Any premarital sex. And the proportion here greatly affects the proportion here. In fact, it's equal to the degeneration. Don't you see? Degeneration here. How's it going to affect your marriage? You bring that degenerate attitude, that fragmented soul, into your marital relationship. Now to the rescue comes doctrine. But you see, this is an optimum. This is an ideal. Now, you want to be real about it? Most people who have suffered this degenerate attitude, most people who have brought preconceived ideas into their marital relationship regarding sex, never utilize the doctrine that can clean them up. You say, well, I will. Good. Thanks for that response. This man's talking to himself tonight. Well, I can't have you talk to me because it would be rude. So I'm speaking for you. Haven't you ever heard of rhetorical arguments? They're not as viciously as you argue with yourself. 21. Premarital sex in adolescence is generally not satisfying but frustrating. It is not fulfilling in itself. This frustration results in bad interpersonal peer relationships and definitely has an effect on mature future marital relationships. You see, the immaturity in adolescence, and I think this is probably one of the areas, if I had anything to do with it, but I don't, God did it for a reason, but if I had anything to do with it, why, men and women, before they reached a certain age, would not have any sexual drive whatever. But the problem is we do. And it's a part of the testing process that we go through in our advance to maturity. We have to learn many times by the hard knocks of experience. It would be great, you know, if there was a switch somewhere on the back of your daughters and what you just simply did was just turn that thing off at birth. Okay? And then you just let them go until they reach a certain age and they said, Dad, I met a young man. And I'd ask, is his switch off? Yes. So he had good parents too, you see. And then at marriage, right after the ceremony, we'd say, come here, dear, let me give you a hug. And then I reach around and go, click, see. But that is not the case. It's not that easy. Be nice, wouldn't it? Now, I know what some of you ladies are thinking. You'd have yours off most of the time. Wait. Remember, a woman isn't a real woman until she's 50. Except in some cases, and I question whether or not some will ever reach womanhood. You know, it is a matter of mental attitude. And in many cases, it has a direct relationship to what you brought into marriage. Point 22, chronic premarital sex does affect marriage and marital adjustments. Optimum sexual blessing and satisfaction occurs amongst couples who are virgins when they marry. So you see, it is worth waiting for. For those of you that waited, and you see, you can't understand what the others are missing. You know why? Because you are experiencing the 100% blessing at this point of your advance in sexual understanding. And the beauty of the thing is, there is nothing that has hampered that advance. There's no blockage. There is no barrier. And as you grow year after year after year in your relationship with each other, I guarantee that it's going to grow greater and greater and greater. But with some, they've already got into marriage with 50% less than they had to begin with. And so therefore, the best they can hit is 50% of their potential. And you know, anybody that knows anything about computers knows this. I've told you this recently, and I'm going to use this as an illustration because it proves the point. I had a hard drive that was starting to go out. It was 20 megs. All right, it had 20 million potential capacity to take that many bytes. Okay, we assume each word, which is not really correct, but each letter would be equivalent to a byte. It's not quite right, but that's close enough. All right, so 20 million characters. Well, about half of the drive was bad. So I try to work around it by saying, well, instead of going out and buying a 10 meg or another 20, I'll just play with the 10 that I have that's good. Okay? The problem is, you know as well as I do, that if you have 20 megs and you've already lost 10, it's not long before you start losing more, right? That's the point. And you see, instead of it getting any better, it got worse. So too with a matter of relationship. You started off with a potentiality of 100 megabytes in sex. But you got involved in premarital sexual relationship, you destroyed half your hard drive. Now you're trying to recover. See, you don't even know what you're missing, you clucks. But if you got with a doctrinal program and it became a priority that it should be in your life, you'd be amazed at what God can do in recovering the destruction that you have created in your soul that you may not even be aware of, that you just may become aware of before the study is over. Or possibly you found out about it within the last few weeks. But see, people who started off as virgins without any premarital sexual experience, they got 100% to go. 100%. No blockage. Nothing hampering them. And when they're at the age that people say sex wears out, oh, they're riding high. Excuse the pun. All right, so chronic premarital sex does affect marriage and marital adjustment. Optimum sexual blessing and satisfaction occurs amongst couples who are virgins at the point of marriage. And we assume by that as well, virgins that haven't used themselves as their own partners. One of the questions you might ask, are there types of premarital sexual activity that are more damaging than others? Well, obviously, yes. I mean, if you've married as a virgin and yet you've had some experience with self-satisfaction, to be kind, you're not as likely to have destroyed as much of your soul as if you had had that same experience with the opposite number that many times. Are you with me? Do you understand what I'm trying to tell you? Okay. Point 23. Ephesians 5:3 warns us, but fornication and all licentiousness or insatiable erotic desire should not even be mentioned among you as a part of protocol saints. The King James says, these things should not even be discussed among you. And I'm loosening up the translation a little bit. The idea is that there are certain things that you can discuss with each other, but this type of terminology, things about fornication, making light of it, or even jokes of it, is not healthy. Why? Because for the single, this becomes an arousal factor. You know, I didn't, quite frankly, I always thought I was naive, but I guess it wasn't naivety as such, but rather being protected. You see, when I was 5 years old, most of you know that I immediately went to a private school, and the private school was a military academy. I went there until I was in my early teens. All right? Now, I knew, obviously, you're not going to pick up anything illicit with regard to sex in that type of an environment. At least the environment that I was in, you didn't. Okay, it was of the old school and military as such. Then I started to rub shoulders with society. I was released, as it were, from that environment, and I went to a public school. Boy, the things I began to hear, and I said, no, that can't be true. And of course, yes. And then, of course, you have to talk to somebody else about it, and somebody else has to talk to you about it, and then you're so confused and so mixed up. And then the jokes come your way. Well, now you see, in my case, I was in my teens. You know what's frightening to me? The grade school kids are now telling jokes. And you say, well, where do they get it from? Probably from their stupid, ignorant, jackass parents. Now, you want to tell stories to each other and have a laugh, that's fine, but don't ever say it in front of your children. Or, if you have cable, don't ever let them sit there and watch that stuff and say that they're not, it's not injuring them. What do you think they are, stupid? They're like little blotters. They're like a sponge. They're soaking up that information. It's unbelievable. I have a grandson that for at least a year he thought he was one of the characters on a TV program. I suspect that he still thinks he's part that character. What was the guy's name? Jack Burton, yes. I mean, me walking the house, I'm Jack Burton. Hey, you know, I say, hey, come on, kid. Kid was 2 years old breaking chairs. Of course, you see, one of the dangers with that is that if that child is uncontrolled, they're playing out on the playground, some little kid says something to it, and all of a sudden a karate chop across the bridge of the nose, and little Susie has a busted nose. Now, I'm just giving you an illustration. All right, so is that a danger? Y'all agree? It's a danger. It's an influence. Well, what about exposing a 7-year-old to an R-rated movie? Even the unsaved society have enough sense to tell you that a particular movie should not be observed by anyone under 17. And you got 12-year-olds in there. And you say, well, they're adult for their age. Oh, sure. Oh, that's even worse. Because that means their sexual drive has accompanied their adulthood. My, we have some silly standards in life. And one of them is what we allow. And then we wonder, we say, why is my kid involved with, why is he so, every time he opens his mouth, he's talking about some woman, some girl, and parts of her body, and he's got pictures all over the house. Well, you've taught him well. Okay? Ephesians 5:3 again in closing, but fornication and all licentiousness. Licentiousness, by the way, is simply a word which describes any form of illicit sexual relationship. This is a word, incidentally, that I'll never forget. because we had a black pastor on Long Island, a very nice man, very doctrinally sound. Oddly enough, his name was John Brown. Okay? And he was a very big, strong black. I was glad he was on our side. And every time he'd see me, he'd run over and hug me and just, I mean, we had a phenomenal relationship. And occasionally his church and ours would get together and we'd have fellowship together and so on. It was really great. He was one of the few men that I've met that was that sound, okay? None of this, you know, business and so on. Of course, they did their singing, and there's no one that can sing better than black people in church. I wish we could sing that way, but we're not built right. Our vocal cords don't work properly. But nevertheless, and so he was telling me one day he was being introduced, and he had just received his license to preach. And the guy that introduced him said, "And we have with us this afternoon our licentious brother, John Brown." And of course, John, being a bit more educated than this clod, started laughing. And he couldn't wait to call me to tell me that he'd been called licentious. The guy used the wrong phrase, obviously. He wasn't licentious, he was a licensee. There's a vast difference with you carrying a license in your pocket or carrying something that's licentious in your pocket. You don't see the difference. Well, see me afterwards. A lot of people are going to have to see me afterwards. Licentiousness is insatiable erotic desire. These things should not even be mentioned amongst protocol believers, much less practiced. So let's establish a policy. Let's keep our filth and our jokes with that regard where they belong, in the sewer. Try it. It might encourage your spiritual advance instead of destroying it. Never end a message on a negative note. Let's see. The next point says, marital compatibility or marital love is reinforced by premarital chastity. Positive note for most. Let's pray. You're dismissed. Thank you, Father, for the principles that excite us to understand thy plan and purpose for us as believers, and the beautiful things that you've prepared for us in every detail of life, even to our sex life. Dismiss us now, we ask. In Christ's name, amen.